Hello, and welcome to Resources Radio, a weekly podcast from Resources for the Future. I'm your host, Margaret Walls. My guest today is Lala Ma. Lala is an associate professor of economics in the Gatton College of Business and Economics at the University of Kentucky, where she holds the Carl F. Pollard Professorship in Health Economics. Lala is also, I might add, a new addition to the RFF University Fellow family, which I'm really pleased about. Lala's research focuses on estimating values of environmental quality as assessed through housing markets. Some of this research involves use of what are known as hedonic property value methods, which we're going to talk about today. And she's also an expert in the estimation of what are called locational sorting models, models that look at the factors, including environmental factors, that determine where people live. And a lot of Lala's work examines the distribution of outcomes across people of different incomes, and she's written several papers on environmental justice. Today, we're going to talk specifically about a paper she recently published with co-authors in the journal Land Economics. This paper just came out, and it's entitled Risk Disclosure and Home Prices, Evidence from California Wildfire Hazard Zones. Now, wildfire is a serious problem in the Western U.S., and we've had other podcast episodes about wildfire, so many of our listeners probably know about that. But one of the key reasons for it is population growth in what's called the wildland-urban interface, or the WUI. And it's an open question whether and to what extent people really understand the risks when they make those location decisions and take them into account. So this paper looks at the important role of risk disclosure, and we're going to talk to Lala about that paper and its findings and also some ongoing work she has on wildfire risks. So stay with us. Hello, Lala. Welcome to Resources Radio. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Margaret.
So before we dive into our topic today, I want to ask you a little bit to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you kind of came to your particular career path and your work on the kind of combination of environmental, housing, health, and equity issues. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So I was an undergraduate economics major at Tufts. This is in Massachusetts. And I was, I guess what drew me to the major in when I was an undergraduate student was just how some of these economic models might explain individual behavior and decision making. And I think I did have an early interest in looking at how data might support that. And then in graduate school, kind of one of my favorite courses was something called non-market valuation. So here, what I thought was really cool was how you can use people's decisions to kind of back out or reveal their preferences for an attribute attached to some good that they were deciding over. So the example that's relevant to what we'll talk about today is the housing market. So people make decisions about where they want to live. And this is based on attributes that are attached to the house, one of which could be environmental quality. And so if environmental quality might impact the price, we might think that the contribution of environmental quality to price is kind of an implicit price for what people are willing to pay for that good. The nice thing is that we can then, by getting an implicit price, try to calculate, for example, the benefits of a policy that affects the environment and compare that to other policies that might have nothing to do with the environment. And so a lot of this, you know, this in this area, you can get at people's preferences by using housing market analyses or studies, but you could also try to get at valuation in other ways. So you mentioned I had some work with looking at health. And so one way is to measure the direct impacts of health on health of exposure to an environmental bad. And then you can monetize that using something like an estimate of what people are willing to pay to avoid the risk of death or illness. And I've done some work in this context looking at shale gas development. And then, you know, with respect to the work on equity, I think the more I worked in this area on valuation, it became kind of apparent that people held different values for environmental quality. And you can kind of infer this based on data showing that different types of people are exposed to different amounts of pollution, and in particular along the lines of socioeconomic status. And so then the question is, well, is this actually because people had different values for you know, environmental quality, or is something else going on? For example, other forces such as regulation or decisions made by, you know, other stakeholders that are contributing to disproportionate exposure. And so all this kind of contributed to my interest in equity issues and environmental justice, as many call it.
Yeah. Well, that's good background for this paper. So I gave a little bit of background at the beginning. So tell us a bit more about it, Lala. What exactly you and your co-authors set out to look at in this study and what the motivation was for this work?
Yes. So in the study, my co-authors, you, Margaret Walls, Matt Wibben-Meyer, and Connor Lennon, are using purchase decisions in the housing market to try to estimate whether and how disclosure about wildfire hazard through regulation impacts housing prices. And so here, if housing prices are impacted by disclosure about risks, then we take this as evidence that people's decisions regarding where they lived are being influenced by whether there is information about fire risks and whether it's disclosed. So here, if we find no impacts, it suggests that risk disclosure in the wildfire context, at least, is not so useful for homeowners, and that people kind of already have full information or all the information they need to make their housing choice. So as you mentioned earlier, damages from wildfires have increased in recent years. So it's really important that we know whether people are internalizing these risks. If they're not, it suggests a potential role for maybe public policy to help facilitate this information, in this case, through public disclosure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I want to kind of draw a parallel to flooding, Lala, and I know you've done some work on flooding. So there's some similarities and some differences. What are the key differences in sort of mapping and information disclosure of risks when you compare these two hazards?
Yeah, no, that's a great parallel to draw. So we think the most important differences between wildfire and flooding are kind of twofold. So first, wildfire insurance is generally provided through homeowner insurance policy. It's not a standalone policy that you purchase. Whereas in the case of floods, insurance you have to purchase separately. And so it's possible that people may let their policies lapse. Second, there's no federally mandated maps on wildfire risks. Whereas in the flood case, the National Flood Insurance Program requires mapping of flood risks through flood insurance rate maps. I think those are called FIRMs, right? And so the thing is, these two differences affect how people might trade off costs of living in a location with disaster risk. So depending on whether they have insurance, their insurance coverage, and then also the extent to which people even know about the risks that they're potentially facing.
Yeah. Okay, so your paper, our paper, I will say, focuses on California. And that's the state with the biggest wildfire problem. And it is also the state with some interesting and unique disclosure requirements that kind of made this study possible. So can you tell us about how disclosure works in California?
Yes, sure. So California law requires sellers to disclose the wildfire hazard for their properties in certain areas where there is higher risk. So the types of areas that require disclosure are based on the degree of wildfire hazard, and this is known as the fire hazard severity zone, and this is delineated by different maps. And then it also depends on the type of jurisdiction a property is in. So there are several types of jurisdictions, federal, state, and local jurisdictions. We call these responsibility areas. And so during the time frame of our study, properties located in very high fire hazard severity zones require disclosure when the house is being sold. And then also properties in moderate and high fire hazard severity zones in state responsibility areas also require disclosure. The other areas do not.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so that's good background too, because we're going to come back to that. So let me ask you now about the data and the methods, Lala, that you use. Can you tell us about the data first? What data was involved here?
Yeah, so we used housing transactions data for the universe of home sales in California. The period of analysis for our study is 2015 to 2022. And so these data were made available through the Ztrax database from Zillow. And so this is really cool data because it gives us information on individual home sales. And this includes information on such as the sale date, buyers and sellers, the characteristics of the houses, so number of bedrooms, number of bathrooms, and importantly, the location of the house. And so here, the precise location of the house allows us, that information allows us to kind of map where houses are relative to these fire hazard severity zones and responsibility areas. And I do want to say by us mapping, I mean a very talented RA at RFF who mapped and recovered these spatial relationships between the homes that we're selling and the and whether they're in one of these disclosure or high-risk areas. So after we've done this mapping, this allows us to figure out whether a sale occurred in an area where disclosure was required or not.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, that RA is Emily Joyner, and she is quite talented, so we'll come back to her too. Okay, so the methods then, once you have all this data, Lala, there's always some challenges in these kinds of models because lots of things are correlated with each other. So teasing them apart and identifying the effects of one thing, in our case, wildfire risk disclosure, can be hard. So talk about that a little bit, because that requires some special techniques. And what did we do to kind of handle that problem?
Yeah, so this issue of kind of teasing out what contributes to price is prevalent in all sorts of analyses that use this type of data. And I should mention that, you know, our paper that's published in Land Economics is part of a special issue where all the papers in the issue use this Ztrax data for different applications. So the specific challenge that we're dealing with here is that higher wildfire risk areas are more likely to require disclosure, but then places with higher wildfire risk also have shown that they've had better kind of access to amenities, things like greater access to open space, better views, et cetera. And so this means that the price difference of disclosure regulated areas versus unregulated areas not only includes the effect of disclosure on prices, but also the price effects of these differences in other amenities that's correlated with disclosure status. And now we control for a lot of these differences in our analysis, but it's impossible to control for everything. And so we need a strategy to deal with this. So what we do then is the following. We focus on a very narrow neighborhood around these regulation boundaries. So specifically 300 meters around these regulation boundaries. And we compare the prices of houses sold on the regulated side with the unregulated side. And so now in this narrow kind of neighborhood, disclosure, when you cross that boundary, disclosure regulation changes discreetly. But the amenities, whether we observe them or not, should stay relatively the same in this narrow window. And so what this does is ensure, or better ensures, this apples to apples comparison. In other words, the only difference between houses on either side of this boundary is disclosure regulation, so that any price difference that we captured could be attributed to that difference. Now, we also don't want to, you know, this price difference to be due to increasing fire risk, right? Going from the non-regulated to regulated side, since we're trying to capture that pure effect of disclosure. So what we also do is we focus on high fire hazard severity zone areas and also control for a continuous measure of fire risk, which is the wildfire hazard potential.
Right. And then we're just picking up the regulation and not the change in the hazard, right?
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. 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 So a lot of hard work goes into this. Okay. So tell us about the findings. What did we find in the study?
Yeah. So we found that houses in regulated areas that are, you know, within that 300 meters boundary sell for about a 4% discount compared to those in non-regulated areas. I think that's our headline kind of result. And so if you're willing to believe that we've kind of done a decent job in purging the effects of those other correlated differences with disclosure, you might interpret this as disclosing the risk, the wildfire risk, causes prices to fall by 4% on average.
And do you interpret that then as it's that disclosure is making a difference?
Exactly. So it suggests that disclosure is potentially imparting additional information about fire risk to people. And this is causing them to affect what they're, you know, willing to pay for a property.
Right. Yeah. I mean, people could have information from other sources. So is it kind of a lower bound on that effect? Or what do you think about that?
Yeah. So for one thing, we are comparing people or purchases on the regulated versus non-regulated side. So what we're really capturing is a difference that disclosure makes. It's possible that people in areas where risk is not disclosed still have information about risk, right? And so in that sense, we're kind of removing that, you know, that kind of discount they're already willing to pay. So this would be considered a lower bound on the actual willingness to pay to avoid wildfire risk.
Yeah. So that 4% roughly figure, did that magnitude make sense to you, Lala? Is it in line with any other studies you know about that are out there, either for wildfire or maybe in the flooding space or something like that?
Yeah, I think we did a little bit of a literature review in the paper, and generally the magnitudes seems reasonable based on what previous work has found. There are various strategies that people use to try to isolate the effect of like disclosure on prices or risk on prices. And so many studies in the disaster context, so we're looking at kind of regulation and kind of these fire hazard zones, right? How that changes prices or disclosure. But many of the studies in the disaster context use disastrous events to try to recover the effect of risk on prices. Now, there are clear differences between that and what we're doing, but you can kind of think about it in a similar way as if wildfire events are communicating risks to individuals, similar to how disclosure is communicating risks to individuals. And so we also compare our work to kind of this type of work, and it seems that our estimates are a little bit smaller in magnitude, but in the range.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. So we have some follow-on work going. So I want to give you can offer a teaser to our audience about this. And this involves development of a locational sorting model, which I just explained at the beginning as kind of you're an expert in that. And this is in the wildfire context. So can you describe, why don't you tell folks what we're doing now in this project? And maybe we have a few preliminary findings that kind of stay tuned for folks. So tell everybody what we're working on now. It's kind of an extension.
Yeah, sure. So in this follow-up work, I think we're still interested in the effects of disclosure, but we're going at it in a slightly different way, and two main things are different now. So first, you know, as you mentioned, we're explicitly modeling how people choose where to live, and so this is through the sorting model. And then second, we've, in this follow-up study, recovered more information about the individual homeowner making that housing decision. So whereas in the previous paper, we're really only looking at detailed information about the house, okay, rather than the person buying the house. So combined, these two things allow us to kind of better explore heterogeneity and preferences to avoid wildfire risk. So we plan or have started to look at how demand to avoid wildfire risk will vary by disclosure regulation and by income. And so this might be interesting to look at because it might raise some equity issues with policies that try to either address wildfire risk directly or indirectly through providing information, for example, through disclosure. We've also mapped out a different form of heterogeneity. We've mapped out a person's wildfire experience. So this is whether a wildfire occurred near a person's prior residence before buying their current home. And this allows us to think of almost like a different type of risk information communication, kind of like what I mentioned earlier. And so we're interested in seeing how this might matter in housing decisions with respect to wildfire risk. So if you want a teaser, I don't have specific numbers for you, but we're finding some interesting kind of patterns. So Currently, we're finding that higher income households have higher willingness to pay to avoid wildfire risks, so they have to be compensated more to contend with this higher risk. And this is regardless of whether disclosure is regulated or not in an area. We're also finding, like before, that disclosure matters. So in areas where disclosure is not regulated, the willingness to pay for wildfire risk is positive. So this is a little bit counterintuitive. But then when you look at disclosure regulated areas, this willingness to pay becomes negative and statistically significant. So disclosure is making a big difference there. And then interestingly, on the fire experience part, we're seeing that people with fire experience in the past actually have lower willingness to pay to avoid wildfire risk. So we're still trying to interpret that and try to figure out what's going on. But it does suggest, if anything, there's an important distinction between the source of information of these risks. So is it experience versus ex ante risk disclosure?
Yeah. Do you want to just say for a second, like the data issues, what did we have to do to sort of both get these individual characteristics and then match them with whether they had fire experience? I mean, just say a little bit about that.
Yeah. So this was a challenge. And I'd say the other members of our team did a fantastic job in doing this. And so for recovering information about the individual. So we had income information and information about prior fire experience. For income information, we merged this housing transactions data with data from the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act. So this is basically mortgage applications data. We did this merge, I think it was looking at information on the year of sale, the census tract of where the house was sold, and the loan amount. And those things are available in both, you know, data sets. And this allowed us to get, if we can match in this mortgage applications information, we can get a self-reported measure of income and also race, if you're going to look at that as well. And then, so that's how we got income information. The second piece, which is this fire experience. So Z-Trax database, so the housing transactions database I mentioned, had individual buyer and seller information. And so what we did also was look at the name of the buyer and look within a year of that transaction, whether a seller with the same name, within a year, whether there was a seller of the same name, and looked at that location of where that seller sold their property. And so we inferred from that where the person was located previous to their current purchase. And then based on that location, we mapped it to fire events that occurred, which allowed us to infer whether there were any fires in that area.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of work but went into that. And yes, neither you nor I did that part
of
the work. Yeah. But I think there's going to be some interesting findings here, based on both the income information and the fire experience. There's some new insights. I mean, I do want to say, like, one thing we've talked about, Lala, is sort of policy simulations, like what could we look at with this model? And those are things we haven't done yet, but maybe you want to say a little bit about that. Like what are the advantages of kind of doing a model like this for looking forward?
Right. So, you know, based on some of these modeling assumptions, you can back out a welfare measure. So how does a change in some particular dimension makes someone better off or worse off given their choices. And so one of the things we had talked about potentially looking at is, well, suppose we change the cost of insurance in these areas. Does this make people worse off? Well, if it's more expensive, it probably makes people worse off. But the question also of interest is, how does that welfare change vary by income in this case, the income gradient. And so that's something we can calculate and look to better understand the distributional consequences of insurance reform, for example. The other thing I think would be really interesting to look at is kind of this value of information, because we are getting kind of this value of disclosure or getting the impacts of disclosing wildfire risk. So we could look at, you know, in the absence of disclosure, how are people made worse off, right? And so I think those would be valuable kind of counterfactuals to look at with this model.
Right. Yeah, I do too. The insurance question looms large these days, that's for sure. So we're running out of time here and we need to close our podcast, Lala, with our regular feature, which we call Top of the Stack. And that's where I would like to ask you to recommend a book, an article, a podcast, really anything at all that's caught your attention lately. What's on the top of your stack?
Well, so I'm about due for my second child. So I've been reading a lot of pregnancy books, and this is not a new book, but I highly recommend the series of Emily Oster's book. Just from for an economist, you see kind of, it's a great literature review of everything you might need to know for pregnancy. But so that's been taking up a lot of my attention. But I have picked up recently a book called The Two-Parent Privilege. I don't know if you've heard of this book. This is by Melissa Kearney, who's an economist at Maryland. And so this book is about the economics impacts or implications of marriage. I think she provides like lots of data-based trends of marriage in the U.S. and then their aggregate impacts. I haven't gotten very far in the book, but a lot of my interest here came from kind of my own upbringing in a single-parent household. And you know, it's really hard to think about the counterfactual of how I would have turned out if that hadn't been the case. But it does make me reflect back on how policy might have influenced my family structure, the family structure I was raised in, and, you know, then how things could have been very different. It also makes me feel very grateful that I have someone else I can rely on to help, you know, watch my kid if, you know, someone gets sick. So,
I think I've heard of that book. Yeah, that's a really good point. Mm-hmm. Well, those sound great. Thank you so much for sharing. It's been a pleasure having you on Resources Radio, Lala, and learning more about your work, our work. We're going to stay tuned for the new research. And thanks so much for taking the time to come on the show.
It's great to talk about this and talk with you. Thanks.
You've been listening to Resources Radio, a podcast from Resources for the Future. If you have a minute, we'd really appreciate you leaving us a rating or a comment on your podcast platform of choice. Also, feel free to send us your suggestions for future episodes. This podcast is made possible with the generous financial support of our listeners. You can help us continue producing these kinds of discussions on the topics that you care about by making a donation to Resources for the Future online at rff.org/donate. RFF is an independent, nonprofit research institution in Washington, D.C. Our mission is to improve environmental, energy, and natural resource decisions through impartial economic research and policy engagement. The views expressed on this podcast are solely those of the podcast guests and may differ from those of RFF experts, its officers, or its directors. RFF does not take positions on specific legislative proposals. Resources Radio is produced by Elizabeth Wasson with music by Daniel Ramey. Join us next week for another episode.